From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Artist June Wayne is credited with reviving the art of lithography in America. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk to Wayne about her unconventional choices in her art, in her personal life, and in juggling the two. Also, we talk with writer Bernard Cooper. He just won the prestigious Penn Award for a first work of fiction for his collection of essays about growing up in Southern California. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Seizing the Enigma, a new book about Allied efforts to break Nazi Enigma codes during World War II. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. American military personnel in northern Iraq are about to start construction of a second tent city near Zaqo to house Iraqi refugees. Military officials say the first camp will have to close its doors to new arrivals within the next 2 days. From Cizre, Turkey, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
Relief workers are struggling to accommodate the flood of refugees who are now arriving at a rate of 3,000 a day. They continue to pitch tents for the new arrivals, but they say they're barely keeping up with demand. Yesterday, workers had to stop registering refugees when the supply of tents ran out. There are now 13,000 refugees living in the tent city, and by the end of the week, camp officials estimate the population will reach 20,000, which is the camp's capacity. The number of refugees returning from the mountains is expected to increase. Those who are now returning are doing so on their own accord, but in the next few days, Allied officials say they'll begin bringing helicopters and buses up the mountain to bring back those who are unable to make it on their own. I'm Deborah Wong reporting.
South African President F.W. de Klerk has announced a ban on many kinds of weapons in an effort to curb violence in the black townships. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela had asked for a total ban on the carrying of weapons in so-called unrest areas. That would include weapons that Zulu tribes people regard as their cultural right, such as knives and spears. The ANC maintains that such weapons are often used against its followers. De Klerk said today that spears would not be included in the ban. Fighting between supporters of the Zulu Inkatha Party and the ANC has taken some 5,000 lives in the past 4 years. The White House issued a new travel policy today, prompted by reports of Chief of Staff John Sununu's excessive use of military jets for personal and political purposes. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The new policy requires Sununu to clear all of his travel on military planes with the White House legal counsel. It's the result of a review of more than 70 trips Sununu has taken on military planes over the past 2 years. The review largely clears Sununu of any wrongdoing, but says he's guilty of, quote, innocent misunderstanding in some cases. The policy replaces old rules adopted in 1987 that required the chief of staff and the national security advisor to use military planes so as to remain in constant communication with the White House. The use of government planes for personal or political travel is now banned except under specific circumstances. Reimbursement for trips taken on military planes that are not official is not changed under the new policy. It's based on the commercial coach fare, often about a tenth of what it actually costs the government. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 40 points today to close at 2,971. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in active trading. This is NPR News. A congressional investigator said today that the Census Bureau's special effort to count homeless people was so flawed that it's virtually useless. The Bureau spent $2.9 million in a one-night effort to count all the homeless people on the streets and in shelters. Nye Stevens of the General Accounting Office said the count was useless as a tool for designing programs for the homeless because the one-night count probably missed so many people. Homeless advocates have denounced the census count, saying that an erroneously low number could hurt homeless aid programs. Sexual battery charges have been filed against William Kennedy Smith for his involvement in an alleged Easter weekend rape at the Kennedy compound in Palm Beach, Florida. Todd Rosenthal reports.
Palm Beach State Attorney David Bloodworth says a 9-page police report detailing the alleged Easter weekend rape at the Kennedy compound contained all the information he needed to file sexual battery charges against William Kennedy Smith. Bloodworth told reporters the case is now in the hands of the courts.
The work done, the personal review that we have the authority to do, and we've done for almost 20 years now, indicated to me that this evidence that I reviewed met the standard for filing a case, which is a standard that goes beyond probable cause for a prosecutor, and I have followed that standard, and I filed this information in good faith.
Smith's attorneys have agreed to have their client turn himself in to Palm Beach Police early next week. For National Public Radio, I'm Todd Rosenthal in Palm Beach, Florida.
Economists in Canada say there are now clear signs that country's year-long recession may be coming to an end. A Canadian government report released today said that housing starts were up by 33% in April, and analysts said they expected gradual improvement to continue. At the same time, a Canadian business group reported that business confidence posted a sharp increase after five straight quarters of losses. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A good friend of mine who's a curator told me I ought to talk to June Wayne when she came to town. I didn't know who Wayne was. She's not very well known outside the art world. I learned she's considered to be the artist most responsible for the American revival of the form of printmaking known as lithography. And she's a woman who had to defy conventions personally and professionally to remain an artist. Wayne was born in 1918 and had her first solo gallery show before she turned 20. She started off as a painter. When she began making prints in the 1940s, she realized there were virtually no master printers left in the United States. She had to rely on commercial printers who treated her lithos as if they were restaurant menus. In 1960, she received a Ford Foundation grant to start the Tamarind Lithography Workshop, which she directed for a decade. The workshop, based in California, trained master printers and succeeded in reviving the dying form. Wayne continues to work in her own California studio. She's in Philadelphia to give the commencement addresses at the Moore College of Art and Design and the School of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. I asked Wayne how the creation of the Tamarind Lithography Workshop helped her as an artist.
It hurt me as an artist.
Oh.
Because when I organized Tamarind, I was one of the few artists in this country who was any good at it. So I was in the catbird seat. I was doing what the French call raising foxes to eat my chickens. My role in relation to Tamarind has not been seen, I think, in its proper dimension. I conceptualized it, invented it, brought people together, etc. Had I been a man, there would have been nothing unusual about being a leader and being credited as such. But for many, many years, it was assumed, A, that I was an administrator or a teacher, not somebody who could philosophize and then lead a movement. And of course, having founded it in 1960, that was the time when women behaved themselves. Remember, we were just out of the McCarthy period. It was a very conservative time in its mindset. So that the assumption, the general assumption was, that to have received all this money from the Ford Foundation, obviously I must have earned it on my back, or that there was some male who really was doing the work. And it's only in recent, the last few years, that I have retaken my own history by reframing, as I'm doing at this moment, the nature of my role. For me, Tamarind was a work of conceptual art. And as I am accustomed to working in many media, not just lithography, that seemed perfectly natural for me to do.
Let me ask you, when you felt that people were making the assumption that, oh, you were a teacher or administrator, but not an artist, not a philosophizer, not a leader, and when people assumed that, oh, she got to the stature on her back or something like that, mm-hmm. they wouldn't just come out and say that to you. So how do you pick up on that? What were the cues that you picked up on?
It's surprising how often you do hear what people say. Sometimes people would just say it, or say it without realizing they were saying it. If I was speaking publicly, mm-hmm. they would refer to me. I might be introduced as a teacher, which I have never been, or or the executive secretary of, or the administrator of, that kind of thing. So those were direct. There was common, I had a nickname, TBIC.
What's that?
That bitch in California.
Who nicknamed you that?
Well, it went, I mean, I know where it came from. I thought it was rather funny to think that I could have so much resonance all the way from Los Angeles, which was considered to be the outback, you know, in the 60s.
For the visual arts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who nicknamed you that?
I'm not going to mention names, but it traveled all over the world.
Uh-huh.
And it was, so there was that. But then there are all the other cues by which women are received or perceived. And since I'm the daughter of a feminist, I was tuned to those as well because they were realities with which I had to cope. You can't cope with them by head-on collision if you're going to get anywhere. But you have to be able to flow around them or even cater to prejudice in order to continue on a constructive path.
My guest is artist June Wayne. You say that your mother was a feminist. Mm-hmm. In what respect was she a feminist?
Well, she was a she was a feminist and a pacifist. She was also a working woman.
Mm-hmm.
She was a traveling saleswoman in the corset industry. And she never found it odd that although she believed in women's rights, she was selling a kind of garment that oppressed women in the name of style. She used to say to me, however, June, if you're wearing the right panty girdle, you can never be raped.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the logic behind that?
Well, the logic was that a panty girdle in those days was a formidable garment, and she felt impenetrable as well. But so that...
gee, that's great. Panty girdle as self-defense.
Yeah. Well, you know, those corsets full of whalebone and power net elastic and so on were very hard to get in and out of under the best of circumstances, let alone if you were also fighting. So she viewed what she was doing not just as a fulfillment of women's proper image, you know, being put together properly, but also as a sort of defense against aggressors, inviting an aggressor and rejecting him as well.
So did you wear corsets when you were a
teenager? No. She used to send she used to send them to me in California. She lived in Chicago. And these small castles would arrive. You know, they were medieval. And I would put them carefully in a drawer. But I always wore those tiny little two-way stretch girdles that you could buy for 99 cents. And when she'd come out, she'd open the drawer, look at all this very expensive lingerie that she had sent me. And she'd say, "You're taking the bread right out of my mouth."
So she wore them, I take it.
Oh, of course. She believed they were good for your health, and it kept things and parts from falling out, as it were.
How are they good for your health?
Don't ask me. I mean, that was the prevailing belief, you know. And when she was a girl, she was a secretary, one of the secretaries to Bernard McFadden.
Who was?
He was the original health nut.
Oh.
And he was also the founder of Cosmopolitan.
Oh.
A Popular Mechanics, Red Book. He was a great publisher in popular magazines, all kinds of them. But he had an Encyclopedia of Physical Health, in which is really worth your time to look into. It was so funny. So Dorothy, who thought he was very funny, nonetheless picked up many of his views about physical culture.
Dorothy was your mother?
Yeah.
Do you have any of these corsets as souvenirs,
yes,
as mementos?
I did a suite of prints that are a biography of Dorothy, like her history in 20 freeze frames, coming out of the original material letters documents and of course, drawings of her. And one is called Secretary to a Publisher, in which she sits in front of a very large page out of the McFadden Encyclopedia of Health, including several quotes. But in also in it, I include one print of her best-selling brassiere. And then I did a little suite, an ancillary suite, called Next of Skin, of a merry widow. Do you remember those? Bustier, they call them now. Several brassieres, one of those two-way panty stretches that she sold. And then I did two jock straps as well. Jock for sport, with the design of Adidas sports stripes, and the other one called Jock for Cocktails, of a silk, dark green with black elastic, dressy jock strap, rampant on a lionskin field, and with little unicorns running through the fabric. I tried to balance out the lingerie of men and women.
I'm always interested in people who call their parents by their parents' first name. How come you call your mother Dorothy?
Two reasons. One is that I saw her as a separate individual.
Besides mother.
Yes. I didn't define her in terms of being my daughter. For one thing, she was, in effect, the father of our little family. We were three women, my grandmother, my mother, and I. My mother was divorced when I was an infant, and my grandmother was widowed early. So that our roles as a family were defined in a different way than in a nuclear family. And that was very helpful to me because she really broke with my father, and I never had to choose between warring parents. Now, she went out and earned the living. My grandmother took care of the house and raised me, as it were, and I was expected to look, you know, to carry my share. So that by the time I was 15, I was already working, and I left home close to 16 and supported myself from then on. So it was possible, you see, to see Dorothy as a member of the household, almost like a sister.
Mm-hmm.
And our relationship from then on was as one person to another. And she had quite a different profile of interests than I did. She used to say to me, "I'll never understand you, but I guess it's all right."
My guest is artist and printmaker June Wayne. She's credited with reviving the art of lithography in America. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Artist June Wayne is my guest. Coming from a pretty unconventional family and from a pretty feminist family, what was your mother's and grandmother's reaction to you wanting to be an artist?
You must understand that the stereotype of a girl, when I was a girl, was that doing handicrafts and making things pretty was fine. To be a girl was actually an asset. If you said you wanted to be an artist, a young boy would have been straightened out at once because he had to support a family, right? Or else he might be a sissy. But the crunch would come when you were older and you still wanted to be an artist. At that point, a boy would be taken seriously and a girl would be expected to make watercolors on the dining room table while the kiddies were sleeping and choose the right chintz for bedspreads and curtains, you see. So there was that warp in perception of boys and girls and of men and women, and that perception has been strengthened in recent years.
Certainly, you think so?
Oh, yes. I think women have lost a lot of territory in recent years as compared to the gains we made in the 70s.
So was there a point in your life where you felt that the pressure was for you to get married, have children, and paint pretty watercolors?
Oh, yes. I think the 50s, the 40s and the 50s, we were very much defined and by the idea that you would be somebody's wife and that if you were a mother, you were a certain kind of a mother, and that that came first. And so it was a very difficult a stereotype for me to break out of.
Did you ever marry or have children?
Yes, I did. And I have a daughter. But I organized my life, and often with great difficulty, to try to fulfill both roles. My daughter was in college before she realized, really, that she knew I was an artist, but before she really realized who I was, she came home from school one day and she said, "We were reading in a book about an artist named June Wayne. Is that you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Why didn't you tell me?" And I said, "Suppose I had, would it have made any difference to you?" And there was a long pause and she said, "I guess not."
You actually hid from her that you were an artist?
It isn't that I hid from her, but that I fulfilled my responsibilities that as they affected her, but also bought my own time to be who I was. In that sense, I lived two lives, and I learned a variety of ways how to use my time so effectively that I could buy pieces of it. For example, I used to work all night, and I learned to do with very little sleep, or to sleep in snatches so that I could then do what I wanted to do. But the time, by the time she was 12 or 13, I really split out of that completely.
Can I ask you how seriously your husband took your work?
He thought it was very, at that time, that husband thought it was all very nice as long as it didn't get in his way.
Did it?
Oh, yes, it did, in many ways. And it was difficult. I think it was difficult for him, but it was impossible for me.
How so?
Well, because one is what one is, particularly someone as deeply an artist as I am. I mean, that's, when I was a child and people said, "Hello, little girl, who are you?" And I'd say, I wouldn't give my name. I'd say, "I'm an artist." And it's very important to be able to accept yourself. And as an artist, you have to do that, because if you're any good, the art world most of the time will disapprove of you, even the art world. If you're any good, you're ahead of it, you see.
Mm-hmm. Was there a turning point in your life when you went from trying to pretend, even to your daughter, to the rest of the world, that you weren't an artist and that you were fulfilling your function as a wife and mother and woman in society? When you went from that to saying, "Well, I am what I am. I'm an artist, and I'm not going to have to stay up all night and not sleep anymore in order to be able to be a wife, mother, and artist."
Well, I never defined myself as wife and mother,
mm-hmm.
So that wasn't too difficult. But I did split in the 50s. I left home, my daughter, my then husband, and I went off to Europe, and I really thought I might never come back. It was just too much. And from then on, I never went back into that cage.
It must have been really something for you to leave your daughter especially.
Yes.
How old was she?
Well, she was in her early teens. And it isn't as though she wasn't provided for. But the point is that teenagers are really adults already. We pretend they're not, but we forget that only in recent time have we babied children so long, keeping them out of the labor market, keeping them in school for years and years and years, when they are not only at their peak, but in the case of boys, are rapidly over the hill by the time they're 18.
What kind of guilt, and I'm making an assumption here that you felt guilt, but I'm sure you did. What kind of feelings did you have to overcome to make that decision to leave?
I must say that I had less of a struggle with that than others, because from the kind of vantage point that I had all my life, and with the kinds of kind of role model that my mother represented, she wasn't fully out by any means, out in the sense of being unconventional from the outside. But I knew from the time I was a very little girl that there were nuclear families, and then there were other families, and that they lived side by side. And so I never felt that I had to conform to what other people thought. And I must tell you now that my view is, if it doesn't amuse me and it doesn't educate me, to hell with it.
Do you and your daughter ever talk about that decision you made years ago to go to Europe? I wonder what her reaction is to it now as an adult herself.
Well, I couldn't possibly speak for her.
Yeah.
I wouldn't try to.
Did you ever get close again afterwards?
Oh, yes. We see each other almost every day. It isn't that. I think that for everybody around you, being straight out is the best way. You get all that stuff out of the way, and then you can make connections to people because they know who you are, and you know who they are. And you take the good with the bad and get on with your life, which is very short, after all.
Do you feel that you've become a mother figure in a lot of ways to younger women artists over the years? Because there haven't been a lot of women for younger women to use as role models.
Well, I don't much care for role models.
Mm-hmm.
And I disclaim that position. If a young artist or a young woman or anybody wishes to learn from what's available or to follow a particular course of action that someone else has taken and that seems to have worked for them, fine. That's fine. But if you have to find a role model in order to make your way in life, you're in deep trouble. Because each of us is obliged to swim alone in that sense. It's you have to draw on what you are, and you have to watch to see what kind of water you're swimming in.
June Wayne, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Artist June Wayne is in Philadelphia to give the commencement addresses at the Moore College of Art and Design and the School of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Bernard Cooper just won the Penn Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award for Fiction, but he won it for a book of essays on his childhood. The judges called his book an astonishing collection of daring and highly evocative texts. Coming up, we meet Cooper, and he reads from his new award-winning book. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about what some say was more important to Allied success in World War II than the invasion of Normandy, cracking the Nazi Enigma codes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush met today at the White House with U.N. Secretary General Perez de Cuellar to try and work out security arrangements for Kurdish refugees in northern Iraq. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
President Bush is pushing a British proposal to send a U.N. civilian police force into northern Iraq to guarantee the safety of the Kurds. Iraq Today rejected that plan. Nevertheless, the Bush administration believes the UN has the authority to intervene without another Security Council resolution. Today, the president underscored his determination to turn the security problem over to the United Nations.
We have always looked at this relief effort as limited in duration. We are now in the process of turning these efforts over to the United Nations, and we look forward to working with the UN to hasten the day when all these refugees can return home.
But Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar told the president he believes the Security Council must approve another resolution before a UN peacekeeping force intervenes. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney says that Saudi Arabia and five other nations in the Persian Gulf have agreed to U.S. proposals for post-war security in that area, including an increased U.S. military presence. Cheney has been on a trip to the Gulf region and is now on his way home. In Yugoslavia, the country's leadership has ordered the army to restore peace in Croatia. After 3 days of talks, the leadership announced a 6-point agreement calling for the disarming of civilians and disbanding of paramilitary groups. The agreement stopped short of declaring a state of emergency to end the clashes, in which close to 20 people have died. Talks between the South African government and the African National Congress appeared deadlocked today over the issue of whether spears can be carried to political meetings. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Yesterday's 6-hour meeting between President F.W. de Klerk and Nelson Mandela was followed up today by meetings between their advisers. President de Klerk said in a statement late today that progress had been made, but he said he's not willing to ban the carrying of spears to political meetings. It was President de Klerk who made it illegal to carry these weapons last year by a proclamation that the Inkatha Freedom Party had asked for. Inkatha said that carrying certain weapons was a cultural tradition. ANC sources said today that Nelson Mandela is willing to compromise on most of the points that are under discussion, but he's adamant that so-called traditional cultural weapons must be banned from political meetings because they are used against his followers when the meetings are over. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 40 points to close at 2,971.15 on volume of some 180 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. For the third time in as many days, a tornado hit Bangladesh. These storms follow last week's dangerous cyclone, which killed more than 125 million people and left millions of people homeless. Meanwhile, heavy rainfall and high winds have disrupted relief flights for survivors of the cyclone. Airport officials say that all flights this afternoon were grounded and some streets in the capital were flooded. Once again, officials have appealed for more helicopters and transportation to carry food and clothing to survivors. So far, about $400 million worth of aid has been pledged by more than 20 countries. On Capitol Hill, the House Armed Services Committee has taken the first step toward enabling women to fly combat missions. The panel approved a plan last night that would remove a ban on such missions. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The surprise amendment to the defense budget bill would remove the congressional ban on women taking part in combat missions. Congresswoman Pat Schroeder of Colorado, co-sponsor of the plan, said in Operation Desert Storm, women proved themselves by flying everything but fighters.
women in the Air Force could fly the refueling planes, but they could not fly the fighter aircraft or the bombers. In fact, 97% of the slots women could qualify for in the Air Force, but they couldn't be the top gun.
The plan is still a long way from reality. It must be approved by the full House and Senate, and then it's up to the individual services. The Air Force has indicated it supports the concept, but the Navy is lukewarm, and the Army and Marines have rejected it. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Doctors say that President Bush's thyroid condition has been caused by Graves' disease and began iodine treatment this morning. A spokesman says it's anticipated that Mr. Bush will be fully restored to good health very quickly. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bernard Cooper's first book, Maps to Anywhere, has just won the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award, given by the writers' organization, PEN. The award is given to an American writer for a first published book of fiction. But Cooper's book is really a collection of essays. The award judges, Peter Cameron, David Levitt, and Carol Masso, said these pieces were part prose poetry, part memoir, part song, which, dictated by Cooper's love of language, his reverence for memory, and the quirky shapes experience takes, expand the notion of what fiction can be. We wanted to meet the writer the judges were so enthusiastic about, so we invited Cooper to talk with us and to read from his book. Here's the opening of his piece, The House of the Future.
I was 12 when I saw The House of the Future. It was past the gate to Tomorrowland, commissioned by Walt Disney and molded from Monsanto plastic. Composed of four modular wings cantilevered from a pedestal, all the walls gently curved. The entire structure appeared to hover, weightless and white, more of a craft than a habitat. Shaded by its massive shadow, my parents and I waited in line, impatient for our tour through. Mother was dressed in her Mondrian muumuu, a few big blocks of primary color. Father in his Hawaiian shirt, a snarl of palm fronds and stalks of bamboo. I wore mouse ears and madras shorts. "Can you imagine?" Mother exclaimed, craning her neck. Father nudged me. Suppose this was home. Hour after hour of my life had been spent in just such supposition. I was a boy obsessed with the future, searching through my comic books for tomorrow's uncanny manifestations. Cars humming above the earth, equipped with anti-gravity engines. Supermarkets stocked with hydroponic produce. String beans hefty as baseball bats. Pea pods huge as canoes. Cryogenics commonplace. The dead suspended in beds of ice to thrive again when science permits. Time was a road that led to utopia, or so I believed. And life, prolonged, would be nearly perfect. Humankind molded like plastic till virtue and peace and pleasure prevailed. On the pages of my comic books, all the astonishment promised by the future was evident in architecture. Amphitheaters beneath glass domes, arcades on the tiers of ziggurats, conical towers piercing the clouds and bridged by walkways and tubes. Efficient, ideal, inevitable, the buildings of the future would look like machines.
How much did you buy into that idea of the future when you were young? Did you really believe in it?
I really did. I mean, I did go to Disneyland as a child, and I had a kind of precocious interest in architecture from the time I was about 11 or 12 years old. I was fascinated by Frank Lloyd Wright, by Mies van der Rohe. And, you know, like most kids who grew up in the mid to late 50s, there was the sense that America was on this endless road toward progress, that eventually all disease would be conquered, that there was sort of this limitless and bright future. And I have to admit, I believed it for a while, although I think I was always aware that there was sort of a dark underpinning to all this, that there was something a little bit malevolent about the possibilities in the world as well. And I think I was always aware of that conflict, too, but I wanted to believe that everything would be sort of perfect and shiny and wonderful when I grew up.
Well, your heart was in the home of the future, but you lived in your parents' house. What was the house like?
Well, the house was actually a very typically Southern California house. It was a Mediterranean house, very thick walls, cool during the summer, arches, dark wood, Spanish tile, So it really bore no resemblance to the kind of houses that were at Disneyland or in the comic books that I talk about in this piece. And, of course, apart from the architecture at home, the home life there was very different as well. My brother was ill when I was very young. My parents had their domestic problems, and there was definitely a discrepancy between the way life was and the way life was supposed to be.
Now, your piece that you read from The House of the Future isn't just about your interest in Walt Disney-style futurism. It's also about your brother who was dying of leukemia when you were growing up.
Right.
And can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to put both of those ideas together in one piece, what the connection is?
In retrospect, at any rate, I think that I realized that those ideas were together during the period when my brother was dying. I suddenly realized one day that I did have this obsession with utopian architecture simultaneous to the demise of my brother. And as soon as I thought that and realized the discrepancy between those two things, the sort of willful wish to have a perfect, pristine, clean future, and then the, of course, sorrow of what was happening in the house, it seemed sort of stunning and amazing to me, and something that I wanted and I think in some ways needed to explore in my work.
How old were you when your brother was sick?
I was about 12 years old.
What were your responsibilities to him? And were you the older brother or the younger brother?
I was the younger brother. Actually, I'm the youngest of three. And I don't think I had any responsibilities in regard to him in terms of taking care of him, but I think I enjoyed the notion that I might be able to entertain him. There was something sort of appealing about the idea that he was home and he was always there for me, and there was a kind of intimacy. Ironically, because of the fact that he was bedridden, and yet, of course, it was a horrendous thing to witness at the same time.
Well, let me have you read an excerpt of the part in that piece that's about your brother dying.
All right.
And this is about when he's really getting close to death and what your reaction is
right.
to his bodily changes.
In the weeks that followed, Dr. Wirtz doubled the dosage of Gary's medication. My parents took turns walking him several times a night, plying him with pills. As a result of one diuretic, my brother was constantly dehydrated. His skin bloomed with scales he scratched and shed. I was seized with panic at the sight of his face and arms. The sour smell of his body was unbearable. I began to believe, with a new and superstitious conviction, that my brother had become contagious, that remnants of his skin were everywhere, hidden in the carpet or floating on the air, ready to infect me. I kept my door closed. I held my breath in the hall. I would not walk barefoot. I adopted my mother's concern for cleanliness, wiped the doorknobs with disinfectant, ran hot water over forks and spoons. I refused to enter my brother's room, refused to smile with my parents and talk of swimming and college and marriage, even after Martin urged me to be kind. Martin was my brother's nurse at the time.
Did you confess these thoughts to anybody?
Not at the time, no. In fact, I think one of the reasons why I was compelled to write about this was there was a tremendous amount of silence about this while it was happening. My parents, understandably, I suppose, in some way, really tried to maintain a positive attitude, although it wasn't working. And oddly enough, it was not discussed much, partly, I think, to maintain a kind of perhaps false hope, and also because it was just too painful, I think, for any of us to confront outright. It was very difficult for that reason.
Were you upset that you were allowing yourself to be overcome by these fears of contagion? Were you criticizing yourself for that at the time?
Absolutely. I was really drawn toward my brother to be with him, to spend time with him, perhaps even some sense to save him in a way. And yet I was subject to these feelings of, well, revulsion, really. And it was very difficult, very, very much a conflicting feeling.
Do you think that your brother's death made you any more scared or any more adventurous in how you approached your own life?
I think probably both. I think that it was, suffice to say, a very frightening and affecting experience. But I think that one way in which it affected me is that it made me very aware of the elegiac nature of art. And I think that's an element that runs throughout all my work. I would like to think that if life is short, then at least there's a possibility that art can somehow fix experience, that it's an elegiac procedure in some way. And that's one of the reasons for my fierce attachment to art, is trying to fix things, to make things matter, to make things permanent, I think, in some way.
My guest is Bernard Cooper. His book, Maps to Anywhere, just won the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award given by the writers' organization PEN. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Bernard Cooper is my guest. You're talking about, like, fixing something in memory and I guess also trying to, like, make things matter. You know what I mean?
To
give them the weight that they have when they're fixed in time through art.
Right.
But I wonder what you feel your responsibility is to, in dealing with memory, to the truth as it was lived,
mm-hmm.
versus manipulating the actual truth a little bit to maybe come up with a larger truth that will have more literary meaning, even if it's not completely true to the reality of what happened.
Right. Well, that's an issue that absolutely fascinates me. One of my favorite writers is the writer Bruno Schultz. And something he said, which I found so moving, was that memory is the fixed fund of capital which a writer draws from for the rest of their lives. And I've always found that to be the case. And I take a lot of liberties with my work, I have to admit, and memory is a very fragile, very tenuous thing, and often in the process of writing, I realize that there are lapses in memory or spaces, and I really am very willing to fill them in with fictive elements or to just do the best I can in terms of remembering them. And I think that it has the effect that you mentioned, that it seems sometimes closer to the truth, a little bit of exaggeration or distortion for the sake of art can actually give a greater sense of veracity or impact to a work of art, even if it's not absolutely true.
You have one piece that's called Childless, and you write that you're childless and intend to stay that way.
Right.
And if you're willing to talk about it, I'd be interested in hearing why.
Well, the reason is that I'm gay, and it's funny, there's a kind of prejudice, I think, or astonishment on the part of some people when you mention that you not only really don't want to have children, but don't really feel regretful about it. I don't dislike children in any way, but it's something that I've resigned myself to and am perfectly happy about, and something that I wanted to write about as well. There was something about the notion that I was the end of the line, in a sense, and that seemed kind of compelling and moving, a little frightening to me, and I wanted to deal with it.
That notion of being the end of the line, is that a self-imposed notion, or is that something that came from your parents?
Well, I think it's a self-imposed notion. I'm the last remaining sibling alive at this point, and I'm gay, and I'm not going to have children, and, there's something pretty amazing about that, and I wanted, again, to address that somehow in my work.
You said you're the last remaining sibling?
Right. I had three brothers, all of whom have passed away over the last, about 15 years.
What's happened to them?
Well, one of leukemia, one of cancer, and one of a heart attack.
Wow.
Yeah. Very scary.
Must make you feel awfully vulnerable.
It does. It was also very strange because my last remaining brother, Ron, who was about 58 years old, died when I was in the middle of this book, this novel about a young boy's relationship with his brother. And it was so sort of disturbing to me to have that happen in the middle of this book that I actually stopped writing for a number of months, trying to sort of digest it all. And it was a very difficult period.
Do you feel comfortable writing about your brother's death? About any of your brothers.
Oh, yeah.
and their deaths.
Well, no, actually, but Boy, this is a sort of odd thing to say, but I don't feel comfortable writing about it, but it's precisely the discomfort that compels me to write about it. I think that usually something that drives me to work is when an idea is a little bit disturbing or uncomfortable or odd, inexplicable in some way that necessitates my writing about it. And I think I've got a lot more to write about my family and all the things that have transpired since I was a kid.
I guess if something makes you uncomfortable, then you know you're really getting to something.
I think so. I think that's true. And there's a way in which things can come too easily and be a little bit too funny or flip. And those things are usually the things that I end up throwing away. And those tones are usually the tones that don't last very long in any given piece. They often turn a little bit darker eventually. So. You know, and I like that kind of edgy sense of working with material. It's a little difficult and a little disturbing.
Well, Bernard Cooper, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
And congratulations again on the award.
Thank you very much.
Bernard Cooper's book, Maps to Anywhere, is published by the University of Georgia Press. It just received the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award from the writers' organization PEN. This is Fresh Air.
To human health. It's Thursday, so we'll be reading some letters from listeners. And also from Hungary, NPR's Peter Breslow takes us on a nighttime tour of Budapest after communism.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During most of World War II, German U-boats were sinking more ships than the Allies were building. These submarine wolf packs threatened to sever the lifeline of food and equipment that was keeping Britain alive and fighting. The U-boats were guided by what were known as Enigma codes, and the Allies knew they had to break them. Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book that tells how they did it.
The World War II story of the code breakers of Bletchley Park has always fascinated me. Maybe because it's the only instance I know of where scholars became heroes by using their specialized knowledge to help win a war. Bletchley Park was an estate north of London where, beginning in 1938, British intelligence began to assemble an oddball assortment of agents. There were lots of professors and gifted undergraduates from Oxford and Cambridge, mathematicians, philosophers, astronomers, classical scholars, and modern language specialists. Chess fanatics, including the chess correspondent for the London Times, were also recruited to Bletchley Park, along with crowds of debutantes who served as confidential clerks. This sounds like prime material for a Monty Python skit, but British intelligence had a serious reason for concocting such a strange social stew. It needed, desperately, to break the German U-boat code. In Seizing the Enigma, David Kahn suspensefully describes the Allied struggle to win the Battle of the Atlantic through intelligence research. Kahn's book ranges from a mini-history of modern cryptology to tragic accounts of U-boat attacks at sea. But for me, the riveting center of his story is the race between the intellectuals at Bletchley Park and their nemesis, an electrical cipher machine known as the Enigma that coded all the U-boat messages. The Germans thought that the Enigma codes were uncrackable, and their arrogance was justified. I've seen an old Enigma machine here in Washington at the Navy Museum. It looks sinister, sort of like a manual typewriter sprouting nerve ganglia. Khan is such a clear and knowledgeable writer that he even gives a math-phobic person like me some sense of how the machine worked. Its codes were so effective that Khan says if 1,000 cryptanalysts, each with a captured or copied enigma, each tested 4 keys a minute, all day, every day, the team would take 1.8 billion years to try them all. Lousy odds. But the astounding fact is that by the middle of 1943, Allied intelligence was deciphering almost all of the Enigma messages. And remember, this was a pre-computer age. The Bletchley oddballs cracked the Enigma code through their combined raw brain power. Mathematical geniuses like Alan Turing devised theorems that unlocked some of the serial regularity of the codes. Mavis Lever, an 18-year-old university student, used her language aptitude to solve hexagrams and help crack the Italian naval code. Intelligence agent Ian Fleming, working with the Bletchley crew, devised elaborate plots for luring U-boats with their Enigma machines into Allied traps. His James Bond novels don't seem quite so outlandish anymore. And brave seamen risked and sometimes lost their lives recovering those Enigma machines and codebooks from sinking U-boats. Khan says that next to the atom bomb, the breaking of the Enigma code was the greatest secret of World War II, even more important than the Normandy invasion. It's also one of the greatest stories of World War II, a story about the daring of men at sea and the hard work of brilliant people hidden in the shadows.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Seizing the Enigma, The Race to Break the German U-Boat Codes. Our reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Bob Balls, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet exiled Iraqi writer and architect Samir Al-Khalil. His book, Republic of Fear, became a bestseller during the Gulf War. Also, writer Nicholson Baker talks about his new book. It's about his obsession with John Updike. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.